So, as I mentioned last lecture, I used to co-teach this with another lecturer. For this semester, that's not happening. I'm going to take all of the lectures. Having said that, the other lecturer, Connor McArdle, had a very nice set of notes, so I'm just going to use them. So apologies, there will be a sort of style shift depending on who originally produced the notes. And Moodle is now Loop, so this morning I posted the long-form notes, which cover all of Connor's portion, which is the queuing and analysis portion of the module, and it's about, a fair number of sort of written pages, and then the slides. Okay, so last time was just sort of a fairly, well, even more than usual, hand-wavy discussion of networks and what are the issues with networks, the fact that they're complex systems, that we have finite resources, that the resources impose sort of delivery constraints or delivery qualities on our data. And what we said was that, if you think of a network as being a bunch of links and a bunch of nodes, then typically what happens is that data is going to queue up at the nodes. Okay, we don't have a good handle on necessarily how it's arriving to a specific node, and we also have questions about how it's going to be served by that node. So if it's packets, how long it takes to transmit it depends on the transmission speed plus the length of the packet. So these are things that we can't say there's sort of a specific number attached to. They're random, they're unknown. And so what we're going to, again, look at in this module is how do we make some sense, draw some conclusions about these random unknown events. Okay. So what we're going to do for the first 2 to 3 lectures, I need to decide when exactly I'll switch over to simulation. We're going to look at the basics of what we mean by that randomness. So we're going to start this lecture with probability. So just how do you quantify randomness for any system? And we're going to move that eventually up to queues and see what we can say then about queuing. Okay. So we'll start with an example of, again, a performance analysis problem. This is a classic example. The solution to this came in the late 1800s, or was it the early 1900s? But anyway, around the turn of that century. Okay, and so again, this is a telephone problem. So we have, obviously, a bunch of customers connected to exchange, and then, again, they're going to have to travel through the network, so exchanges will forward data from exchange to exchange to exchange. Okay. There are a lot less outgoing lines than there are subscribers or subscriber lines. and why is this? Well, obviously because we have lots and lots of subscribers. We can't afford to give, as I said, we can't afford to give each of them their own line. But what we can do is we can rely on the fact that not all of the customers are always on their phones. Okay. So customers will make calls which will have a certain length or duration, and they'll make them every so often. So the question becomes, well, given that it's likely you're not going to have all the customers making calls all the time, how many trunks should the telephone company provide? So the question is, well, what's the consequence of providing less trunks than users? Well, then possibly at some point in time, you're going to have more users trying to make calls than there are lines for them to use. Okay. So, again, we've already ruled out having a line per customer. That's just too expensive. So we're going to run the risk of customers not being able to make their call, not being able to connect. But what we'd like to do is keep that risk to some acceptable level. Okay, so how can we do that? Okay. So why do we even want to do it? Well, as I said, the telephone company is going to want to minimize the amount of equipment they have to provide. Equipment costs money. On the other hand, if customers regularly can't connect their calls, they're going to move somewhere else. They're not going to continue using your service. So you have to keep at a level that customers find acceptable. And with telephony, there are regulatory requirements to that effect as well. So companies are required to provide guarantees about service. Okay. So we need to have some information about our customers. The basic information that you might think about is what's the rate of call attempts and how long does each customer talk. And if you multiply those two together, you're going to get an average usage for the system. The problem with that is that it is exactly that. It's an average, okay? So you could provision for that average, but then you're going to have time, you know, you're definitely guaranteed going to have times when you exceed that average, okay? So what we're going to need to answer this question is a more descriptive model of how the calls are made. So you want a probabilistic description of when customers attempt calls. So part of that is the call rate, but then part of that is sort of how they the calls distribute around that call rate. So, you know, you could have a deterministic where they call exactly every n seconds, or more likely they're going to call at times around that n seconds. Okay. Similarly, you're going to have a more detailed description of how long the calls are taking. Okay, so that's how long are your resources being held. Okay. You need to be able to relate one and two. So you need to be able to relate the action of a customer attempting a call to the system resources being tied up. Okay. And then finally, we're going to have some way of reasoning about that model. And again, what we'll see is that depending, we can either do an mathematical analysis or possibly simulation. Okay. In order to do pretty much either method, we're going to, again, need to develop some theory of how you model probabilities. Okay. And so, you're going to have sort of a basic system for assigning likelihoods to what we'll call events, assigning likelihoods to occurrences. And then, given that basic system, you know, we're going to move on to see how you can sort of build up more complex reasoning. Okay. So we're going to spend the next two lectures discussing this sort of basic mathematical representation of probability. Okay, so this approach is going to allow us to reason about a lot of aspects of communication networks. It's these are the main tools for studying the performance of networks. Okay, so we start with having this idea that our system is unpredictable. So we need to somehow model that unpredictability, and then we use that to ask questions about properties of the network. Okay. So we have things like utilization, which refers to what fraction of time are we keeping the system busy. So again, ideally for us, we want our network as busy as possible, so we haven't paid for too many resources. On the other hand, we've got to balance that out against giving customers an adequate service. So the way you keep a system busy is essentially you overload it, which is great for the system, but individual customers then are going to experience problems with their data delivery. Okay. So, how do we possibly start looking at users, whether they be packets or customers? Well, we can talk about throughput. So, that's the mean number of customers or packets, or whatever, which is processed in a particular time frame. Okay. And so your unit there is customers per minute, packets per second, something like that. We have, from a customer aspect again, we have the idea of waiting time. So how long is the customer in the system? And that's going to be related to queue length. So how is service building up at nodes? Okay. And we also have the idea of, so you have delay. You also have the idea that possibly you're not getting through the system at all. So you have things like blocking probability, the probability of the system is busy in some sense when a customer arrives. Or if you have something like a packet switch network, that's related to the idea of maximum queue capacity or loss then. So you can send your packet into the network, but if it hits a full queue, it's dropped. Okay. So, again, as we go through, we'll see how all of these can be addressed with the toolkit we build up. Okay. So we're going to start at a very basic level with a formal theory of probability. And it's probably more detail than you'll actually need, but you know, the thing about probability in general is that there's a lot of people have a lot of intuition about probability. If you flip a coin, you know, where do we always start? Flipping coins, rolling dice, and you have a lot of intuition about how that works. But frequently, your intuition also leads you astray. So, one famous problem sort of illustrating this is it's called the Monty Hall problem. It's just an aside. You can Google it. But this was a game show. And you have three doors. You have a car behind one door and goats behind two doors. So it's a game show, so the contestant is asked to pick where they think the car is. So the contestant will say, it's behind door number two. Now, Monty will then ask, will then say, well, I'm going to help you out. I'm going to show you what's behind one of the two remaining doors. So he's going to show one. He's going to show the goat. Then he's going to ask the contestant whether or not they want to change. He's going to offer the contestant a chance to change. So, change, not change. Anybody have any opinions?
Change.
So you know the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So the answer is, yeah, you change. Because of the setup, there's a one-third probability that the car is behind the door you originally chose, and a two-thirds probability it's behind the other door. Now, I don't want to spend the lecture necessarily going over why that is. Again, just Google Monty Hall problem and you'll see the problem. But again, it's a indication that, you know, again, our instincts aren't always right. So what we have to do is sort of put things on a formal mathematical footing and actually recourse to that. Okay. So we're going to try to develop this sort of some basic definitions for probability and move on from there in the next lecture. Okay. So what we say is that we start with some sort of random occurrence. So E is an experiment which satisfies the following conditions. You know all the possible outcomes of that experiment. If you perform the experiment so you have a trial, you don't know what's going to happen on any given trial, but we can repeat it. So if we do it again, the sort of same underlying mechanics probability is going to apply. So, you know, again, the easy thing, we're flipping a coin. We say that, well, the only two probabilities are heads or tails. If it lands on its edge, just blow on it. If we flip a coin, we don't know whether it's going to land at heads or tails. And we can flip as many coins as we like. And again, they'll either be heads or tails. We have an instinct with coins that it's 50-50. It's equally likely. So 50-50, you're going to get a head or a tail. Okay. How do we express that? We express it through the idea of a probability space. And we have three components of the probability space. We have start with a sample space, and that's the set of all possible outcomes of an experiment. So for a coin flip, it's either heads or tails. Then we introduce what's called an event space. And it's a collection of events. Each event is a subset of the sample space. Okay. And so we'll see an example of that in a minute. We assign our probability measure. So we assign some likelihood, not to the outcome, but to the events. And again, we'll see why as we go along. And this likelihood is a number between 0 and 1. For each event. Okay. So, again, the events are subsets of sample spaces. We say the event occurs if the outcome of an experiment or of a trial is an element of that event. Okay. So, moving on slightly from flipping a coin, we can look at an example of rolling a die. Again, there's six possible outcomes. So your sample space is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So we can define different events on that sample space. So, for example, we have an event, the outcome is an even number. So that's a set with 2, 4, and 6. Another event is the outcome is less than 4. If it's strictly less than 4, then that's the subset 1, 2, 3. Okay. So again, these events, they're subsets of the outcomes. That means that we can reason about combinations of events, you know, using set operations. So if you have events A and B, you can have events A intersect B, A union B, or the complement of those events. Okay. So if you have A intersect B, that means that A and B both have to happen. If you have A union B, that means A or B have to occur. And A complement means that not A occurs. Okay. So we can create, as an example, a new event, which is a, outcome even and less than 4, which is going to be the intersection of our two events. And in this case, the intersection is 2 alone. Again, a set containing 2 alone. So, what we're going to do then is, if we go back to what our probability space is, we have the sample space, the event space, and the probability measure. And what we're going to want to do is, we're going to need to decide, do we need a structure on the event space? So we've already talked, you know, we've already seen, you know, what would be desirable is to be able to reason about set operations of events. And so we're going to need some rules about our event space, and namely that we pretty much want them to be complete under these set operations. And then we're also going to need to see when and how we can assign probability measures to the events and the event space that we've come up with. Okay. So again, just a very simple example of what we might define is our coin toss. Our trial is going to be to toss the coin once. We have two outcomes, heads or tails. So our sample space is the set head and tail. We define our event space then as all the possible combinations, head, tail, head or tail, neither. So head occurs is H, tail occurs is T. They both occur, well, that's the empty set, and either one of them occurs, that's head, tail. Okay. And, you know, that's pretty simple. We can think, you know, again, if it's a fair coin, we can think about assigning, just listing probabilities for each of those events. So the probability that you get a head is a half, the probability you get a tail is a half, the probability that one or the other occurs is everything, so one or the other has to occur, so that's one. The probability that something else happens is zero. So if you have these simple sets that you can just sort of list out all of the members, then it's pretty easy to assign probabilities. Although one thing you might note is that the probabilities do have a relation to each other. So the probability of head plus, this is essentially the sum of the two probabilities. Okay. So, looking at a simple example like that, you might ask, why didn't we just assign probabilities to the outcomes themselves? And the main reason is that you can't always do that, depending on... we can do that because, again, there's a finite number of outcomes. If we consider a different experiment where we pick a real random number out of an interval, then you have a very large sample space. Okay. The number of outcomes in that space, it's not just infinite, but it's infinite in a special way, which is called uncountable. Which again, what that means is that you can't associate all of the elements to the integers. Okay, so. If you, however many you match up, you still got more and more and more. Okay. So, if you have a space like that, then the probability that you can assign to any single outcome is going to be zero for everything. And you know, again, it's not terribly helpful. What would we do in that case? Well, usually what we'll do is we'd define the probability of being within an interval. Okay. So that's an event. And for that event, we can assign some sort of non-zero probability. And again, you can choose what you want. You could choose that being in the lower half is 0.7 and being in the upper half is 0.3. Or you could say it's equally likely to be in the lower or upper, but you can assign some sort of idea of probability to that sort of an object. Okay, so that's the one very good reason to define events as subsets, is that it's easy, that it allows you to define assign probabilities. Okay, so the second reason is that, again, if we have events, heads or tails, then we sort of have this idea that the negation is also something we can assign probability to. So if you have a head, you can think of, what's not ahead, and you should be able to assign probability to that. You can assign probabilities to unions, complements, intersections, all of these different things. And sort of intuitively, it seems like we ought to be able to reason about that. So, what we'd like is, we're going to assign our probabilities to these events, and we think that in some way we ought to be getting consistent answers. So if we have event A and event B, I'll forgive you since you made my laptop work. If you have event A and event B, and they've got probabilities, well, you think that somehow the probability of A union B must be related, okay? Yeah, and we'll see how and what complexities, but you shouldn't be totally unrelated to those two probabilities. Okay. So, what, again, we're going to do is we're going to put some structure on our event space, and relative to that, the probabilities that we assign to various events. Okay, and again, a lot of this is down to complexity and the fact that people's intuition about probability frequently goes astray. Okay. The foundations for this sort of thinking were laid by Blaise Pascal and Fermat in the 1600s. And again, these guys would have been wealthy men of leisure, and would have known lots of that sort. So we're free to pursue whatever sorts of whatever interested them. And one of their interests that led to this was gambling, or in particular, a friend's interest in gambling led them to start thinking about these issues. Okay. And the basic problem that their friend had was that he said, well, I roll a couple of dice and I want to get double sixes. Okay. So I know what I've got an idea of what sort of probability that has. It's 1 in 36. Okay. I roll a second pair of dice. Well, I must have doubled my probability of getting double sixes. And he went on to make some bets based on that sort of thinking and got himself into serious trouble and decided to pass the problem on to them. So, again, the point of that is that, again, you need to be careful, very careful about, again, what exactly your probability space are, what exactly your outcomes are. And, again, you can imagine if you go from dice to cards, so you're a deck of 54, 52, unless you leave the jokers in, then you can see that it's quickly going to get complicated. Okay. Okay. So again, we have our sample space, which is our non-empty set of all possible outcomes.
And this is what we're eventually going to add our probability to, is to the elements of that space. And it helps to start by thinking of exactly what can be in that space. Okay. So the easiest thing, or the easiest to think of anyway, is that we have a finite sample space, so we can just list out all the elements. So examples of that would be a binary space, 0, 1, heads or tails. You can have more integers, a roll of a dice is a finite set of integers. Keep on going. Okay. If we continue with that thinking, well, the next thing we might think of is what's called a countably infinite space or discrete space. And you might think of just integers or non-negative integers. Okay. So those, again, are going to have a property that it's possible to assign probabilities directly to the elements, though we may or may not want to do that. But then we get to sort of denser spaces, so an uncountably infinite space. Okay, and so the best example of that is the real line. And again, once you get there, you're going to have to be more careful about how you are assigning probabilities. You can't assign a probability to points in the real line. Typically, we can assign it to intervals. Okay. We can have multidimensional spaces then. And you can think of repeating an experiment either simultaneously or in sequence. And then if you have a vector, then the vector is the outcome of each of the individual individual experiments. Okay. So if you're flipping a coin k times, then all the possible outcomes would be a k dimensional vector. If you're picking 10 random numbers, then you'd have a 10-dimensional vector out of the reals, etc. Okay. So, as a simple example, if we roll 3 dice, then each individual die is going to have an outcome in 1 through 6, and if you roll 3 together, then you'll have a vector outcome, each of the elements being drawn from 1 to 6. Okay. So, you can extend that in a bunch of different directions. First, you could have an infinite dimensional product space. Okay, so you can think of, just keep rolling a die over and over and over again. Okay.
So
if you roll it over and over and over again, then again you're going to get some sequence where each element is drawn from 1 to 6.
Okay. So, one useful for us extension of that is, so
again, here we're thinking of a sequence. So 1, 3, 4, 2, 9. And again, we can index that sequence from either 0 or 1 on.
An extension of this is instead of indexing using the natural numbers, what if we index that using T? And you know, we really do have time at the back of our mind when we say T. Then our space is all functions that are assigning values for each time t, and each value is in the outcomes, the possible outcomes.
Okay.
Again, this is actually much closer to the type of thing that we're interested in. So an example of this is that we have packets in the network, and again, the packets are being sent into the network or emitted at a random, generated at a random time. And so what we might observe, what our experiment might be, is to look at how many packets have arrived or been emitted in over the course of time. Okay. So again, if we think of the packets being emitted at the random time, then if we're just observing this, you're going to get some sort of step-like function as time goes on. You know, packet arrives, a second packet arrives, a third packet arrives. Okay. And these times reflect the random arrival, of random nature of that arrival. That's one observation of an infinite number of observations. So we can have endless possibilities for how that, and you know, again, an uncountably infinite number of possibilities for how that experiment would play out.
What's the y-axis here?
That's a good engineering question. What's the y-axis? So that's the number of packets. So we'll say generated. And this is time.
So again, it's going to take us a while to assign probabilities to this or start reasoning about something this complex, but it is a possibility for a sample space. Okay. So no matter how complex your sample space is going, we're going to try and, again, put some order or manners on it through the use of events which adhere to it, some rule in terms of probability assignments as well. So we require a few basic properties for our event space. So again, it's a collection of subsets of our sample space. And we have to have a number of properties for that. If an event is in the event space, then its complement is also in the event space. For any finite number of events, their union is also in the event space. And indeed, the union of all of the events essentially covers the event space, so everything is covered. Okay. So we refer to a set of events that adhere to that property as what's called a sigma field. Okay. So this is sort of sufficient. This is a sufficient set of conditions to define our event space the way we want to. There's a few things that fall out of that, and one of them is that not only are the unions all in the space, but intersections must also be in the space. And you get that through reasoning about the complements and using De Morgan. Okay. So what pops out of that is that the event space is closed under all set operations. So you can take unions, intersections, complements, differences, and they are all still in the event space. Okay. And again, that just it makes sense because, you know, again, you have this notion that, you know, again, if you can assign probabilities to an event, you know the probability of its complement as well. You think you know if you have certain probabilities assigned, you think you know others as well. Okay, so what are some examples of event spaces? Well, the simplest thing you could do is have an event space with two sets, the full set of outcomes, and nothing. Okay. And, you know, again, if you look back, that's, you know, yeah, since the complement of each other, and the intersection union, that's valid. It's not going to be really exciting, you know, one would suspect. Okay, so what are you going to be able to say? Well, the probability of everything happening has got to be 1. The probability of nothing happening has got to be 0. Okay. So there's ways of generating event spaces that are guaranteed to be sigma fields. And the first of these would be using the power set. So the power set is the set of all subsets of sigma. Okay. And so this gives, if you think about it, it should be able to satisfy yourself that would be a sigma field. Obviously, all the subsets are in there, the complements, the intersections, and everything has to be in there. Okay. So, as an example of power sets, if your space has three elements, 0, 1, and 2, then the power set's going to be the empty set, the set of each, the set of one element, set of two elements, set of three elements. And so that's what we get here. And you end up with 2 to the n elements in the end. So, one problem with power sets is that they expand rapidly. So we can look at, if we try and toss two coins simultaneously, then we have, four elements, and then we need to take all subsets of those four elements, and... Yeah, we can keep writing those down. Now, it's possible that we're not interested in all of the subsets, so only some of them are of interest to us. So, as an example, we might think of we're only interested in the event of tossing one head and one tail. Okay. And so the question is, can we find a smaller event space that contains the event of interest? And the answer is yes. So you start with what you're interested in. And so that's either coin 2 is a 1 and coin 1 is a 0, or... coin 1 is a 1 and coin 2 is a 0. And then you just apply all the rules iteratively. So you take the complements, you take the unions. Okay. So the complement is of that of 0, 1, 1, 0 is 0, 0, 1, 1. And so then when you take the union, you get the set of everything, and when you take the intersection, you get the empty set. Okay, so you'll be able to, at least if it's finite, you'll be able to keep going until you don't generate any new events. Okay. So, again, you can go, you'd have A, you'd have the complement, you'd have the union of that, you'd have the intersection of that, and then if you try and go further, you'll find you don't get anything more. So, if we just grind it out by construction, we get the smallest set, which is actually an event space, which actually adheres to our rules. And so we refer to such a constructed event space as a generated sigma field. And so given our events of interest, the sigma field generated by G is given by taking the intersection of all sigma fields on sigma that contain A. Okay, so if you take the intersection of all of them, you pare away what's not common, and you're left with, again, just what's common, so therefore the smallest set. Okay, so we'll do one last event space, and then we'll take a break and talk and return and talk about probability assignments then. Okay, so the last event space that's that we're going to sort of find handy is an event space for the real line. Okay, and so the power set for a finite event space is something you can list out. It's countable. If you try doing the same thing for the real line, so a set of all subsets, then you're going to get a a set that's not countable, so that we can't again assign a probability to the event. We can't assign a probability to the events in the event space. Okay. So. Again, we're going to try and put some shape onto the event space that we define. And in particular, we're going to look at a family of half intervals. Okay. So going from minus infinity to x. We can generate a sigma field for that, and that's referred to as a Borel field. And so what we're going to see is that it's possible, again, to assign probability to these half intervals, and we can then move on from there to sort of the reason about general probability for such a space. So, again, this Borel field is going to be sort of our basic starting point for event spaces that involve the real line. Okay, so far what we've got is this idea of an event space, so we've said that it needs to behave itself in order to sort of, again, in order for us to then think about assigning probabilities to the members of the event space. It's, thinking about that, it's relatively easy. If you've got a finite number of outcomes, if the number of outcomes is infinite, then, again, taken on the real line, then you need to be a bit careful about how you define things.
Mainly what we're doing is we're saying that we're going to confine ourselves to looking at intervals. Okay. And so it's complicated, but we are sort of paring down the event space by doing that. So we'll take a break there, and when we return, we'll take a look at assigning probabilities now to these events that we've defined. So let's think about a 15-20 minute break. Which will allow me to...